Welcome to the National Bicycle Greenway's Mountain Mover podcast series. Here you will get up close and personal with people who are taking giant steps for the betterment of cyclists and for the planet itself.
I'd like to introduce my listeners to a man who has had his finger on the pulse of the needs of people young and old for over half a century. A former teacher, tech whiz, and music promoter, as well as a generous sponsor of our upcoming Eagle Bus Bicycle Tour of the Nation. Bill Lycom has invented an important kitchen accessory, the oven claw, that organizations can use to not only move hot baked goods, but also to shift consciousness. In the words ahead, we'll talk about everything from Bill's fascinating background to his own cause of getting people talking about the importance of preserving wildlife habitats all across the country, to how nonprofits and the like can benefit from his handsome invention. So, Bill, how you doing today, guy?
Doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well myself, Bill. Let's talk about Bill. Bill, before we talk about your oven claw, the story about you is a fascinating one. You started your 37-year career teaching English to high school kids when there were troubled times here in America. That was the 60s. At the time, you were worried about the future of your kids. During this time, what did you do besides sitting just on the sidelines and reading newspapers about what was going on?
Well, I was, at that time, I was pretty active in the anti-war movement. And so I was teamed up with people like Joan Baez and David Harris here in the local scene here in the Palo Alto, and took part in protests wherever they happened to be it Oakland, Berkeley, San Francisco, Stanford. It depended on where it was. And my students at that time knew that I was involved like this. And so, like on Monday mornings after a protest or a sit-in or something on that order, they'd oftentimes ask me, you know, what went down, what happened, you know. And so I'd talk to them about my anti-war attitude. And that sparked a negative take by the administration. They didn't think that I should talk about those kinds of things in the classroom. Anyway, it almost went to the Supreme Court in the end, and the district finally backed down, and everything was cool, and everything went along, and the kids really appreciated what I had to say. In the end, I think they helped to, kind of pave the way for their peers and so forth in looking at war in a different kind of way than just taking what was on the media at the time.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever get tear gassed?
Yeah, very close to it over in Oakland. At the induction center, mm-hmm. We had a sit-in there one time, and the police were coming through, and we got out of there. I mean, it was a very interesting time in that the police were as frightened of us as we were of them. And they had the armament, we had our bodies, basically. And so on this one particular morning, late morning, we got the word that they were coming and that they meant business. And so being a teacher, I had to keep myself on a kind of a fine line between my activism and still holding down my job as a teacher. Mm-hmm. And so as we were leaving the area, you could smell the tear gas, and it was in the air, but it wasn't heavy enough to where you would where it affected me, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And we made it out of there in time. But on the news, though, it came down that it was pretty heavily gassed to break up the demonstration.
So that was probably the closest you ever came to being arrested, I guess.
Yeah. Wow.
And from that, during the early 80s, you sensed that there was another way you could help your kids, and that was with the personal computer revolution. You began proposing educational software. Talk to us about that. What kinds of programs were you working with?
Well, at the time, I was teaching a course in language. It was the history of the English language. And computers were just coming up online. Apple hadn't even developed yet. But there were a couple of software companies down in Sunnyvale that were pioneering some new ideas. And so I don't remember exactly how this all came about, but I put together a sketch of a program that would track the origin of words. And so if you wanted to know the origins of the word, let's say revolution, mm-hmm. okay, you could take this quasi game. And you could plot all the way back through history the various ways in which the word revolution changed when it came into the English language, what its roots were back in Greece, or even back as far as Sanskrit was concerned. Mm-hmm. And it would be all worked out on a map of the world, so you could trace the history of different words and how they fit into the languages at the time. And it was a simple kind of thing that I just started out on, and I made the proposal to one of these companies down in Sunnyvale that they ought to develop it. But they didn't think that the market was ready for such a thing at that time. Mm-hmm. And they were probably right, because that was like, God, maybe 81?
Right.
82?
Right.
Somewhere in there.
Because Apple was 84.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then out of that spun another one that I was a young father at that time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've seen all the pressures on my wife having three kids, and it was just, there was a lot of stuff going on. Mm-hmm. And so I developed a kind of computer game that would track the, well, not track exactly, but it would be, how do you go through a day with the least amount of pressure?
Wow.
You know, for a young family.
Uh-huh.
Like that. Anyway, those were a couple of the...
So what? Whatever became of the... is that entomology?
Yeah, entomology.
Whatever became of that? That sounds like a fascinating program.
Yeah, like I said, it was... I made this proposal to that small... software company down in Sunnyvale, and they looked it over and they thought it was kind of a neat idea. Mm-hmm. And especially for education, which was, you
right,
know,
right.
Really, I mean, there were almost no programs available in the educational realm, mm-hmm. computer programs. But as I said, they didn't go ahead with it because they thought there was not a market, a ready market out there for that kind of thing at that time.
Has anybody developed anything similar to date? Not yet, still, huh?
Not that I'm
aware. I think it's still apropos. It sounds like something.
Yeah, yeah. It could still go.
Wow. Mm-hmm. you helped to popularize funk. You became
not exactly.
No.
Funk was already George Clinton had already developed funk out of the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
My association with it was through the drummer Maruga Booker.
Mm-hmm.
Maruga had already recorded with George Clinton on a couple of his early 80s albums, and I can't remember the titles of them right now.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Maruga was the one of the drummers on some of those albums. And so when Maruga came out here to the West Coast, and I teamed up with him on the West Coast here,
mm-hmm.
then I was introduced to the P-Funk and George Clinton, because Maruga continued to play with them off
uh-huh,
and on,
uh-huh.
as you know, especially when George would come out here to the West Coast, we'd team up and you know, Maruga would play, and I was backstage. I mean, I just hung out with him. And the real work that I did with the P-Funk was on the Mothership tour in 96 or 97,
mm-hmm.
When we went back to New York, and what a trip that was. But anyway.
Literally, huh? What a trip?
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was.
Uh-huh. Huh.
What?
And I got a couple. I think our audience is curious. Can you give us like a broad brush, a few highlights?
Oh, well.
Can't leave us hanging like that, Bill.
Some of the highlights were, I don't know. Meeting a lot of the P-Funk that I hadn't met before, like
mm-hmm.
Belita Woods
mm-hmm.
is one of my favorite all-time funk singers,
mm-hmm.
and I met her there at the hotel when we checked in.
Wow.
In New York City. And one of the other really nice highlights was that we played Central Park one night, and after the show was all over, George told everybody, or his management did anyway, said, "Everybody get on the buses, and we've got another gig down in downtown New York City. So we're going to go down there, and we'll do a late night show down there, and then everybody's free to go until tomorrow afternoon." Because
mm-hmm.
we had another Central Park show the next afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're in this big tour bus, okay, and we're going down the streets of New York City, and we're getting close to this monstrous club, and there are people standing on the streets. We're a couple of blocks away still, and there are people lined up. And headed down, and so just before we came to a stop, the manager got up, and he said, "Okay," he said, "when this bus stops, you get off this bus, you look straight ahead, you go directly into the doorway that's open, into the club. Don't look either way. Go straight ahead." And what we were met with was on both sides of this passageway that the police had created were throngs and throngs of people who were wanting to get into this show. And even some of the people that I knew, they recognized me as I got off the bus. They said, Bill, can you get us in? You know, I had no power to get anybody in.
Wow.
I mean, and so it was hit directly into that door, downstairs into the green room below the stage, and that was it. What a show that was that night. Wow.
This was not Maruga Booker. That was a George's show?
This is Georgia show.
Wow. So he's real popular in New York, I guess, huh?
he's popular all over. He draws big crowds wherever he goes.
Right. Wow. That sounds exciting. Yeah. Jeez. You also had like this thing with online video. I think what you saw there. You felt an importance to help people communicate through that medium. You were the president of a video company. Tell us about that. What was the name of the company and what happened to you guys?
Well, the name of the company was Muzility, M-U-Z-I-L-I-T-Y, taking muse, the Greek word muse, you know, and putting it together with utility. And to tell you the truth, I never did like the name, but it was already in process by the time they asked me to join the team. So I said, well, okay, you know. So what we did was, at that time, this was 2003, okay? At that time, there were two other smallish sorts of video companies that had started up back in the 80s. But their technology back in the 80s, in order to have a video on your computer screen, it was a postage stamp video, okay? It was very small, and so you couldn't see very well. And Tony, the guy who started the company, actually is a friend of mine, he saw that broadband was coming on really fast, and it was fitting into that broadband. He said, look, we can get video out there that is bigger than anything that they've got on the market today. We can put it out there. There are people with a lot of film that they've taken video and going back into actual film that, you know, cameras that people had back in the 60s. He said there's a lot of that stuff laying around, and people want to get it out and get it so it can be seen by family members. And so with that sort of as a premise, we put this company together in 2003. And we went to we had a meeting with venture capitalists because we knew that we needed to be funded in order to carry this off. And in 2003, we were in a meeting with venture capitalists, and one guy got up in the middle of our presentation, and he said, "This will never sell. This will never work." And he said, "Who wants to watch, you know, homegrown movies? Who wants to watch short, little, tiny clips?" And we were dismissed.
Wow!
And what comes along about a year later? But YouTube.
Oh my God!
Comes along, and the guys who started YouTube were already. They were out of, I think, eBay or PayPal. They had come out of one of those two corporations anyway. So they already had the connections with the venture capitalists, and they were solid. They were totally, absolutely funded to the hilt, and because of that, we couldn't compete. And there were a lot of other small. There were a lot of other small startup companies that. Found themselves in the same boat, and they're no longer around, we're no longer around.
Wow. You know? So you preceded YouTube then?
Yeah.
Were they trying to get something going and hadn't come online, come into the service for air, and no one knew they were around, or they just were not around, period?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question, because when they first started to enter the scene, we looked at what they had up there, and it was cheesy, cheapo, you know, video, 2-3 minute clips and so forth like that, and and that wasn't fitting with our business model.
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought, YouTube's not going to work, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. who wants to watch that kind of stuff?
Right.
You know, look at how wrong we were.
Wow.
I mean, totally wrong.
So how big of a window were you putting into your videos? 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 10 minutes?
We had things as short as like 4 or 5 minutes, mm-hmm. all the way up to full length films.
Wow.
Because one of the guys on our team had access rights to some of the old films that were mm-hmm. that had come into public domain.
Wow.
And
yes.
Randy had access to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had like we had some of the cartoons like Betty Boop.
Oh wow, really?
Uh-huh. Yeah, we had a whole series of Betty Boop's cartoons on there.
Oh my God.
We had the Great Train Robbery by uh-huh. What was his name? Edison.
Oh wow. Edison made it.
And I don't know. We did the whole gambit, mm-hmm. you know,
hmm.
all the way through.
So you guys did that till what, 2007 or so, or something
yeah.
like that?
Yeah.
And by this time, you'd retired from teaching?
Yeah. I retired in 2005
wow,
because
okay.
I couldn't keep up with being the president of this company, mm-hmm. which at that time was still growing,
mm-hmm.
okay,
mm-hmm.
But very slowly. And
yeah.
Trying to keep up with my responsibilities as a high school English teacher, you know, correcting papers,
wow,
and
yes.
grading and
uh-huh,
doing that
uh-huh.
thing.
Wow.
I just had to make a decision, and I decided, okay, it's time for me to go try something fresh and new and get out there into the techie world.
Okay.
Which I'd been in, uh-huh. you know, off and on before on the edge,
mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
this was full force, full ahead.
Yeah,
let's
right.
go see what we can
yeah,
do.
And for listeners that don't know, your high school was right in the middle of the Silicon Valley, and sister high school to the same one that educated Steve Jobs, right there in what was it?
Right, mm-hmm.
Sunnyvale or Cupertino?
Cupertino,
okay. And mm-hmm. Steve Jobs, for those who don't know, is the guy that started Apple Computer, or one of him and the other Steve, as in Wozniak.
Yeah.
But
Wozniak.
Yeah. So you had a lot of brilliance coming over the transom when you were in education there in Cupertino, I would expect. Is that correct?
Yeah. There were. As a matter of fact, one of the guys was in my class back in. It must have been in the early 80s. No, wait a minute. I'm trying to track down. It was in the late 80s, okay? We were starting to get Apple computers in the school.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the Apple IIs, I think they
mm-hmm.
were.
Yeah, they were.
So we had this computer lab all set up. And one of the kids in my class, I can't remember his name anymore, but he was one of the first hackers.
Oh yeah.
He'd hack into the school network and damage some of the programming,
Wow. Oh my God.
And I remember one day I said, "Why do you do that?" And he said, "Just for the fun of it, to see if I can do it, you know." And he was one of the original black hat
uh-huh.
computer hackers.
You've also had some famous people that have studied under your tutelage. Is it not correct?
Well, yeah. I guess the most prestigious one would be Phil Wadler. Who is now a professor of information technology at Glasgow University, over there
in Scotland.
Uh-huh.
And
if you look at his resume and the things that he's done since the 70s, all the way up to the present time is just absolutely mind-blowing. He's on the leading edge of programming, computer programming, that is way out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's out there, and I can't get my head around that one.
He also solved a problem, a math problem that hadn't been solved.
When he was a junior in high school, he was taking math courses at Santa Clara University and Stanford, and he solved one of the long-running geometry problems that had been about 150-year-old problem in the area of geometry he took on as a junior in high school.
Wow!
And by the time he was a senior, he had written the definitive solution
to that
problem, and he presented it. I remember he went up to Seattle, and he presented his paper up in Seattle, and in fact, at that moment when he made that presentation, the mathematicians in the audience were aghast that this kid could do what they hadn't been able to do.
And this was when he was your student, is that correct?
He was a senior.
Yeah.
At that time,
uh-huh.
He was in my class when he was a junior.
Mm-hmm.
And so he went on then as a senior and finalized this whole math.
So are you still in? Okay, you retired from teaching. You're not doing anything with video. You're done with all the brilliant kids coming over the educational transom. But you still work with kids, don't you? Music-wise?
Music-wise, I take young musicians under my wing and guide them through the business side of music.
Mm-hmm.
When kids get into playing music and putting together a band and everything, they look upon it as being art, and they, you know, that's what it is, and they're creative, and all of those dimensions, you know, go together, and they really, really, really believe it, and a lot of them don't learn or understand the business side of things as they grow in popularity. You know, they get managers, they get booking agents, they get all kinds of different people to handle the job, the business side, and the band members seldom ever learn that side. So what I do is I teach them that side of it, because it's terribly, terribly, terribly important that young kids putting a band together understand the business of it too.
You also do jazz reviews now. Tell us about that.
Well, actually, it stems from the 1980s when I first signed on with Artist Publications, and I was made the jazz and blues editor for Artist Publications. And I went pretty much, it was on the West Coast here, up and down the West Coast, covering shows, doing interviews with some of the finest jazz musicians alive, like Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald.
Wow.
They became friends of mine.
Really?
Brubeck and people like that. Anyway, the point is that I did that during the 80s, and then In the really late 80s, the Artist Publications had to fold up, had to go away, and that's when I rolled myself over into working with Maruka Booker and putting his whole business side of music together and his indie label and so forth.
Right.
And then, there was that, and then in about 2004, right around in there. I was going up off and on up to the Bach Dancing and Dynamite Society in Half Moon Bay,
which is the
longest running jazz venue west of the Mississippi.
Wow.
It's been going for over 45 years. Pete Douglas has been doing it straight ahead. And in February of this year, Downbeat Magazine nominated it as one of the 150 best jazz venues in the world. And so in about, it was about 04, Pete knew that I was that I had written jazz articles and so forth, and his assistant Linda asked me one day. She said, "Would you be willing to write jazz reviews for, you know, whoever you pick, whoever you decide, whoever comes through here, you know?" And I said, "Well, let me think about that." And so I replied to her later in an email, and I said, "Yeah, okay, I'll do it." So I've been writing jazz reviews for All About Jazz and Jazz West since then.
Wow!
So it kind of got back into the groove of jazz.
Man, so we've got English, we've got music, we've got video, we've got just a billion worlds you've lived in, and now you're getting up very early in the morning and you're studying foxes.
Oh.
Tell us about that. Tell us about those foxes.
Well, they're gray foxes, first of all, and they're native to California. Although they're distributed all the way across the United States. There's only a couple of areas in the United States that don't have any gray foxes. Mm-hmm. But so last year, it was in the morning, and I was going into an area that had no trespassing all over the place. Okay, but I knew that back in beyond those signs, there were orioles. And I wanted to get a picture of a beautiful oriole, a Bullock's oriole, sitting up there in the tree, you know. And so I come around the turn in the this dirt road, and I look down just beyond this pipe gate, this gate that's down there, and there's a sense of fox. And I said, "Whoa, wait a minute, you know, I never saw a fox out there." And I had been taking pictures for about 4 or 5 years prior to that, and I never saw any fox. But here is a fox sitting beside this dirt road and just looking at me. And so I take my camera and I'm shooting, and I'm going closer, shooting, going closer, shooting, going closer. And I got kind of scared there for a minute because I got so close to that fox, it didn't move. I thought, "Man, does that fox have rabies or something? You know, just waiting for me to get close enough and come give me a good old bite, you know?" Mm-hmm. But it didn't have any foam or anything coming out of its mouth or anything like that, which I understand is typical of a rabid animal. Mm-hmm. And I got up to about maybe 10 feet from this fox before it actually turned and went off into the brush. So from that time on, I went down into this little hollow, this what I call now Fox Hollow, and I sat there on a log, and I just waited in the morning, and the young fox would come out, and they'd play, and they'd, you know, I don't know, play with each other, wrestle with each other, and or just lay there, and you know, in the early morning, and for 21 days straight, and then all of a sudden it came to an end. And what happened, I didn't know this at the time, but what happened is long about September, November, right in that period of time, the young fox are old enough and hefty enough to go out and hunt on their own. Mm-hmm. The parents don't have to bring them the food back. So what they dispersed, okay, that ended the season. But I knew that gray fox will come back to the same den to have next year's litter. And so along about March of this year, I went back down into Fox Hollow and I started sitting and waiting. Sure enough, the whole thing is playing itself out. Every morning I'm going down into Fox Hollow. What I'm doing now is I'm observing their behavior. It's not so much, you know, taking nice pictures of little fox. Now I'm observing the behavior of them, because from what I'm reading, about, there's not a whole lot known about the behavior patterns of gray fox. So I hope to use this information someday to, you know, when I get it all together and I think I've got enough and I've verified enough of my observations, I hope to contribute to the literature of the behavior of the gray fox.
So when you say morning, early in the morning, how early is that? 4, 5, 6? Oh,
the alarm clock goes off at 4:15, and I'm down there. I'm down there at Fox Hollow by 5:15, and it's just barely getting light at about that time, and I can't take any pictures at that time in the morning, so. So what I'm doing is that's a large part of the observations, you know, observation time. And when it gets lighter, then I can take a few pictures and document what I'm seeing, you know. Like the other day, a lot of people don't know this, but a gray fox can climb a tree like a cat. I'm going to say better than a cat. Because, and I knew that, you know, I've known that for some time. But the other morning, 2 mornings ago, I was tracking this this fox. It was in a wooded area, and it was just kind of cruising along, you know, not paid too much attention to me being there. And it came up to the bottom, to the base of this tree's trunk. And I don't know for what reason, but that fox just scampered right up that tree. You know, I mean, it was just one moment it was down at the bottom, and the next moment it was up on a standing on a limb looking down at me. And I've got a picture of it shooting up.
Wow.
I mean, I'm shooting up at this fox.
Wow. Jeez. And these aren't just any picture. They're what, with a 40D Canon, something like
that?
Yeah,
Canon 40D.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So you're out in the Baylands. You're out there with the foxes. You're hanging out. You spent a couple hours out there, I guess. Is that about what I'm feeling?
Well, my total time with the fox themselves is about an hour.
Uh-huh.
And then it's getting, by that time, it's like around 6:30, quarter to 7 in there, and it's getting pretty light. They're settling down, you know, for the day, and so what I do then is I make a trek out and around, because I'm the photographer for Bixby Park, Palo Alto.
Okay.
And so I make a round of this one area of Bixby Park, and shoot birds, whatever I, you know, catches my eye. Then later on I'll print those up, and the rangers will post them out at Bixby parking lot.
Okay, so you've been busy all morning working for kind of peripherally for Bixby and for your novel you're going to write about the foxes. Then you come home and you're making it, you're selling oven claws. Tell us what an oven claw is.
an oven claw is a 18-inch device that has a hook, a claw on the end of it, that you grasp the rod on the hot oven and pull the oven rack out so that your food, your roast, whatever you have in there that's cooking is out and away from the heat before you actually get engaged with it, whether you need to stir something or check for, you know, whether it's done. Whatever you need to do with that food, it's out a ways from the heat of the inside of the oven before you ever have to engage with it. And this morning, I stopped by one of the stores nearby, and the owner's wife was there. She bought an oven claw about a year ago, and she just said, "Bill, that I can't thank you enough for having developed and designed that oven claw." She said, "I use it all the time," and her husband Ben said, "And she doesn't have any more burns on her arms." And I said, "That's exactly why I made it, so that people didn't get burned when they reached into the oven, you know."
Yeah.
Because you can accidentally touch anything.
Right.
And you've got that, you're working in that blast of heat that's coming out of the oven. With the oven claw, you just pull that rack out, and you don't have to deal with any of those kinds of things.
Wow, because my next question was going to be, Bill, and I'm sure you get asked this question a lot, and this is how you answer it. Why don't you just grab an oven mitt or a glove or something like that to handle the hot tray?
Because when you do that, first of all, you're not going to get rid of using the oven mitt, okay, in the end. But by using the oven claw, taking that one little extra step, you don't get down. You see, how am I trying to explain?
You don't have to bend down too far?
You don't have to bend down at all.
Awesome.
Because it's 18 inches long.
Right.
You just hook it on there and pull the old rack out.
Yes.
and then you have your oven mitts on, you know, and because if you're going to pick up a casserole, say, out of there, if you're going to, have to have those oven mitts on.
Right.
So they go hand in hand with one another.
So, Bill, are there other people that can benefit from the oven claw besides people that are that don't want to bend over or get burned a lot? Are there other people that it's beneficial for?
Well, yeah, people like who are handicapped, who can't get around, who have, you know. Elderly people whose hands may not be as steady as they once were. The oven claw is really, really helpful for those people. Somebody in a wheelchair, for instance.
Yeah.
Say somebody who was over in Iraq and got injured. You know, and they're in a wheelchair now. Can you imagine? You're sitting there in a wheelchair, and you've got the oven door open. Now what do you do? Well, with an 18-inch oven claw, you reach
for that grill,
and you pull it directly out to you.
Awesome.
You don't have to mess with that oven door that's open or anything like that. You just pull it right out, and it's there for you to handle the food that you got in there.
Awesome.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing too, I had a woman mention this to me, and it struck a real bell. And she said, you know, this is really useful for kids who are beginning to learn to use the oven and to cook and bake cookies and stuff like that. Because she said a lot of times, if it's girls especially, they're afraid their hair is going to get burned or going to get down in there.
Right.
And so she said the oven claw is ideal for kids.
Wow. Awesome. Yeah. Awesome.
So you've got a spectrum of different kinds of people in different situations where the oven claw is just the right thing to have at the right time.
All right, Bill. So what kind of wood do you make? Is it like a handsome hardwood or something like that?
It's walnut. Mm-hmm. We're making them out of walnut and cherry.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
At the present time. We started with maple, but we found that maple was a little bit too brittle.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went to cherry and walnut.
Hmm.
And it's working out very well.
So are they made? Are they made in the United States?
Yeah, yeah. Made over in Ohio by a nice homegrown, family-owned wood manufacturing company over there.
Hmm.
And Tim, the guy who owns it, he took on the job, he said, just simply because I liked the product.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so...
Wow. So yeah. How'd you end up in the kitchen with the oven claw? I mean, you go from English to music to video to, you know, war protest. So, how'd you get so domesticated, Bill?
Well, I was up in Oregon at my brother's place, and it was Thanksgiving time.
Mm-hmm.
And my niece was checking the turkey, okay? Mm-hmm. And she had this flat wooden thing. I'd never seen anything like it before. And she pulled the rack out. And before she checked the turkey, you know, she was checking to see if it was done. And I said, "Tanya, what is that thing?" You know? And she said, "Oh, we call it our oven buddy. my Uncle Earl made this
mm-hmm.
for us." And so after she was finished with it, I went over and I looked at this thing, you know. Simple tool.
Hmm.
And almost immediately, it was like in a flash, I said, "I can make one that is better looking than that. And I bet you I can sell it." And so from there, I whittled the first one out of a piece of pine just to get a kind of design.
Mm-hmm.
Went through a number of steps consulting with people who own woodworking shops, and finally settled on the design. And then I thought to myself, okay, now wait a minute, I've got to get a patent on this. And that's where I got my education on patents, because I went to the U.S. Patent Office online and began looking for similar same products to see if I was if there was an opening so that I could get the patent. And I got it down to within a fraction of saying yes. And so I turned it over to a patent attorney who thanked me for doing all the basic work.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't charge me very much at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, to do the final work on it and to submit it to the patent office. And I got the design patent and took off from there.
Hmm.
I don't know.
Wow.
You know.
Huh. So, if I wanted to buy one uh-huh. oven claw, what do they cost?
Well, on our website, which is ovenclaw.com, they're going for $16.50.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I think there's one other website that has them for $14, although I'm not certain about that. But then they're all over. If you do a search on just oven claw or oven claw pro,
mm-hmm.
A number of sites will come up.
Mm-hmm.
It's like on Amazon, it's on Sears, it's on, you know, some of the big name eBay. It's on some of those kinds of sites. But the way the companies that actually did the posting, the way they did it, some of them are costing $20 out there.
And are these your oven claws they're selling?
Yeah.
Huh. Wow.
But the way in which the background goes with that is that when an order comes in, okay, I actually fill the order.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have any in stock as such. Like eBay.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
eBay doesn't have anything in stock.
Right.
And the company that posted on eBay doesn't have anything in stock. I'm the only one that does. And so when an order comes through, it comes through the company that posted it, which is a different company from mine, comes through them, they know that there's an order, the order comes to me, I fulfill the order and pay the company 12%
Great. So if I were a nonprofit, my National Bicycle Greenway nonprofit, we could buy, say, like a dozen of them or something like that, that maybe cost, and sell them as a fundraiser. Is that possible?
Oh, sure.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow. Any thought given to maybe building a capacity to where I can put my message on it?
Yeah. That can be done. Mm-hmm. I mean, because the oven claw comes just bare. It doesn't have any logos burned into it or anything like that. And so if a nonprofit bought, let's say, a dozen of them, they could take them and they could emboss, you know, anything they wanted to on the oven claw itself. There's no restrictions there.
Like the website and like maybe what their mission is and like a sentence, one sentence tagline or something like that. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds fascinating. We've touched on a lot of things I'd like to go into a whole lot more depth, Bill, but I think we've reached that point where we've pretty much got to wrap up. Is there anything that you'd like to add, Bill?
Well, you know, Sometimes people ask me. They say, "How can you do so many different things?" You know, and I just come back with all the way through my adult life. I've just been kind of living with by what my heart says to do, you know. And I don't know, something pops up, and I say, "Hey, that's interesting." And my curiosity overtakes me, and I just plow right ahead and into it. I have no compunction about not knowing what the hell I'm doing.
All right.
You know, because when I get involved with some of these things, I've never been there before, but I like the journey. I like discovery, and that's what it's all about.
I think
that's probably
why we get along so well. It sounds like you're describing me in a way. You know, it makes it a lot more fun when there's a whole bunch of wiggle room and unknowns and things you got to figure out on your own. So wow. Awesome.
And you got room to be all kinds of creative here and there and everywhere, you know, and so
wow,
it's
awesome.
one big exploration.
Wow. Well, I can't wait to share this and share you, and I look forward to the next time, Bill.
Okay, thanks a lot, Martin.
All right, guy, take care of yourself. It was really a blast talking with you. It really, really was. All right, I'll talk to you soon, Bill. See you later.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That wraps up another edition of the National Bicycle Greenways Mountain Movers podcast series. We hope you enjoyed it. This has been NBG Director and Awake Again author Martin Krieg. To access this podcast in the future and to hear other shakers and movers that we've interviewed, go to bikeroute.com.